All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I tell you, once again, it was like right down to the last minute. It's really, there's nothing to get your adrenaline flowing like a 10-mile traffic jam, okay? But I'll tell you what, the best thing, you can't get mad at a traffic jam like that, because when you find out what it's about, you got to say, I need to be there, all right? Because what it was hundreds and hundreds of cars taking thousands of people to a demonstration to condemn the Armenian genocide, all right? So think about that. Really important. So I'm just full of adrenaline and happy that I was in that situation this morning, but that I made it here as well. All right, we have a packed show. It's going to be a really, it's going to be one of my favorite shows, I know. All right, at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking to the director and the author of the book on which a play is based and the main actor in the play. And the play is called Recorded in Hollywood, and it tells the story of Dolphins of Hollywood, just an amazing record store that was at the center of a lot of what eventually erupted in the whole movement in the 1960s and the rest of that. So that's going to be very, very cool. But before that, we have the writer and director and two actors in a play called Dreamscape, which I have to tell you folks, you've got to pay attention on this one. It is one of the heaviest and one of the most profound plays I've seen in a very long time. So definitely don't go, if you got to get a drink of water, you got to go to the bathroom, do it before you hear this interview, because this is going to have you riveted. All right, it should have you riveted. Opening the show up, I'm pleased in some ways, very pleased to welcome back to the show Carl Dix, but also in other ways, just very angry that we do this, it seems, week after week after week. Carl Dix is from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he's going to be here talking with us today about the killing of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Yeah, it's let's just jump right into this. You wrote a statement about Freddie Gray's murder, and in it you basically pose why, And I want to jump into that, because it's like, it's the thing that keeps pounding at you, Why? Why so many people did?
Yeah. Well, what it comes down to is so many people are dead at the hands of the police, because this is the concentration of a slow genocide targeting Black and Latino people. I mean, you have a system that has ripped the legitimate ways to survive and raise families out of the inner cities, and their program for dealing with the people who are left with little or nothing to survive is cops, courts, and laws targeting people and criminalizing people. And that all is at issue in Freddie's murder, because here you have a young Black man, 8:40 in the morning, walking the streets. Police roll in, and Freddie decides to leave. And then the police take that as that's criminal behavior. And they chase him, they tackle him, and they arrest him. Mm-hmm. For nothing. For nothing more than he ran when they came. They arrested him, and in arresting him may have injured him severely, because he's screaming like he's in excruciating pain as they drag him to the van, put him in the police van, handcuffed, and then they drive around the city. He's already asked for medical attention. In addition to screaming around pain, he suffered from asthma. He's asking for medical attention. They drive him around the city for 20, 25 minutes. And the distance from where they picked him up to the police station is like 5 or 6 city blocks. They could have driven it in a couple of minutes, but they drove him around. And he's in the back of the car, handcuffed, with no seat belts, being bounced around. And something that the police in Baltimore call giving you the rough ride. Hmm. And Freddie, when they finally get him to the station, he is unconscious. They finally call an ambulance. They get him to the hospital and find out that his spine has been severed. And they operate on him, put him in a medically induced coma, but he dies a week later. So this is what happened. And then we get a cast of characters coming out and telling people, be calm. Don't assume that the police did anything wrong. Let our investigations play out. And then at the same time, we have apologists from the police saying Freddie did this to himself in the back of the van. This is what people get told, but the good thing that happened here is that people weren't having it this time.
Well, let me interrupt for a minute here, because I want to pursue a couple of other things here, because some of the things.
Okay.
I mean, I'm listening to you, what you're saying, and it's so enraging, you know. And I keep thinking about this, that even the explanations that they sort of put out there, it's terrible to even call them explanations, but the idea that one, they don't feel they compelled at all to explain the gap in terms of what happened in the van, you know, and how did he actually have his spine severed. You know, they said that, and this is something that's very heavy when you think about what you've been talking about and emphasizing for a number of years now, this point about the genocidal assault against black and brown people. They actually had to say, they said, okay, the cops first said, well, he had a knife. Of course, there was no way for them to know he had a knife. And then they also said, a city official said, well, it's not necessarily illegal that he had the knife, but the cops say he had a knife. And then they say, well, we can stop him because he was in a high crime area. Think of what that means. We can stop him because he was in a high crime area. What is that saying about the value of black lives?
Yeah, what it says is that black people in this society go through their life with a target on their back. And just for being black, and it was nothing else, just for being black and being in that area, the police feel they have the authority to harass you, abuse you, brutalize you, and arrest you, and if necessary, kill you. And all of that flows from just being black and in that area. I call it being treated like permanent suspects, guilty until proven innocent, if you can survive to prove your innocence. And Freddie Gray was not able to survive, just as a wave of people, an intensifying wave of people, have not been able to survive those encounters. And look, it's got to stop, and it's up to us to make it stop, because the authorities ain't going to do nothing about it. There are investigations, and they've already got 3 investigations going into this case, but they've investigated cases before, all the way up to the Justice Department, and the killer cops continue to walk free, you know. So even getting an investigation doesn't mean anything. Don't tell us that you're going to look into policies. We want to see killer cops need to be indicted, convicted, and put in jail. And people have to stand up and demand that and say that this must stop, which is the spirit and the mood of a lot of people in Baltimore. I mean, 2,000 people were out Tuesday night. Every night since, there's been hundreds of people, multiple demonstrations happening, moving all throughout the city, blocking traffic all over the place. And that and much more is needed. And the other thing is, people need to get organized. They need to get organized to carry this fight for justice forward. They need to connect with the nationwide movement, and they need to get with the movement for revolution, because this wanton murder by police that is backed up by the whole system is built into the fabric and framework of this system. It's the continuation of the patrols that went around the plantations to make sure the slaves didn't escape. It's a continuation of the Ku Klux Klan and lynch mob terror of the post-Civil War period, and now it's the police doing it. It's got to stop, and ultimately it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to stop it. And that's a message that we've been taking out, because a contingent group of people from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the New York City Revolution Club have been down here for the past few days, and we're going to be joined by more people on this Saturday, because I've issued a call for people to act in solidarity with the people of Baltimore on this Saturday. You can't get to Baltimore, do something where you are. You can get to Baltimore, join us in the streets. There's going to be a Stop Mass Incarceration Network contingent raising the demand of justice for Freddie Gray and an end to police getting away with murder.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the just brutal, horrible murder of Freddie Gray by the Baltimore police. Now, Carl, we have just about 5 more minutes left, and I wanted to actually approach this thing too, because, you know, one of the things that I was saying, I think everything that you're saying is extremely important, including what the actual solution to this is. And at the same time, just to emphasize that, because, you know, there is a point about what do you do in the face of a genocide. And if anybody had any doubt about this, if anybody had the slightest doubt, I mean, you can think about the kinds of things that are going on. When you see that picture of Freddie Gray hogtied, basically backwards, as somebody said, bent like an origami, you know, it's like you see that and you expect all you need is a pole shoved between his ankles and his arms, and they could be carrying him off like repeated thousands of images of captured slaves. You know, you think about that, you think about the fact that when the people do go out in the street, these bastards call them lynch mobs. Imagine that, they're calling the people lynch mobs.
Yeah, that was one of the police apologists saying that the protesters were lynch mobs. And look, he's calling the people who are protesting the murder of a young black man by a squad of Baltimore City cops an act that is repeated dozens of times each and every month by police all across the city. And he's calling people protesting that lynch mobs. He's trying to turn up into down and right into wrong. And we ain't having it. But it is like, this is an extremely widespread problem. And when you see that and see that this is just the concentration of an overall program of suppression, mass incarceration, courts set up to, and laws set up to target black and Latino people especially, that's what we're dealing with. And if you're going to confine yourself to the channels the system has out there for you, you have already lost, because the whole system is backing up this slow genocide and escalating its pace. And you got to say, we have to take on the system that's responsible for this and end its criminal rule, because that's what it comes down to, a criminal system unleashing its enforcers to carry out crimes against the people. And that's why I say it's going to take revolution, nothing less. And we are building a movement for revolution. We've got the leadership for it in Bob Avakian, a man who's dedicated decades of his life to addressing everything that stands between humanity and its ultimate emancipation. We've got a strategic approach for getting from where we are now to the point where revolution could be possible. We call that fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. And look, if people hate this horror and all the other horrors that this system brings down, from the attack on women, trying to strip them of the right to abortion, the drone missile strikes, the devastation of the environment, they need to get with this movement for revolution. And the way to do that, go to the website revcom.us. You'll see all kinds of stuff up there that you need to know. You need to get introduced to this revolution and get with it. People also need to go to the website stopmassincarceration.net and get involved in this movement to stop the slow genocide that's coming down on people.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl, we're going to wrap this up, but I want to let's just stay in touch, man, because this is obviously and clearly a developing scene. And, you know, I keep thinking, too, in the wake of April 14th, the day of shut it down, stop police murder of black and brown people, you think about this. This is not to be tolerated anymore. And in a way, what came onto the scene on April 14th has a lot to do with what needs to happen these days.
Definitely.
All right, Carl. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about the brutal police murder of Freddie Gray in Baltimore and the response of the people out in the streets standing up and saying, we demand justice. We demand that the cops be indicted and convicted. All right, so that's that, and we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the writer, director, and cast of the play Dreamscape. You do not want to miss this segment.
17, 18, 19, frightening when you hit a rat-a-tat sound. 26, 27, every 28 hours, put another body under that ground. Where the governor, he absent, with the prosecutor and the captain. They say the process is democratic, but we getting bullets even though we got the ballot. Where's Malcolm, where's Chewie? Where's Pac, where's Big, where's Tukey? Where's Jay, where's Nas, where's Snoopy? Yelling, the police like Boosie. Blame Nixon, he's guilty with the whole damn system. These filthy cops of attention. Left Mike in the street 4 hours, definition of a lynching. And cause I ain't from down here, they gonna tell me I need to mind my business. I saw him dead with a bullet in his head. Don't tell the fans, I'm a witness.
All right, welcome back. That was Jasiri X with Don't Let Them Get Away with Murder. All right, it's a statement. It's a... Just, you know what, damn it. People just need to think about that and then decide what you're going to do about it, all right? They don't let them get away with murder. Way too many times that has to be talked about. Way too many times. And it needs to be talked about every time it happens because we cannot allow this to go unanswered and we cannot continue to live in a society that treats a whole section of people as if they're nothing but work animals. And even that, even now, it's like they have no use. They have no use for black and brown people. They have no use for black people in this society. So what are they doing? Terrorizing, genocide. And I went to see a play, and it's down at the Los Angeles Theater Center, and it was one of the most powerful plays I've seen in my entire life. And I've seen a lot of plays, I'll tell you. And you know, it was incredible. And the play is called Dreamscape, and joining us to talk about this today is the director, Kirby Hines. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having us.
Okay. And Rachel Walker, who plays she plays the lead character in the film, although it's a little difficult to describe as lead, but it is the center of the play, the heart of the play. And John, you're going to have to help me with this. It's John Faz?
Yes.
John Faz Merchant?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Who is the most incredible beatbox, just incredible. I mean, he creates the entire soundscape. And listen, folks, with his mouth, okay? That's it. And it was like it was just crazy. So let's jump into this because, like I said, the play really just – and, you know, the night I was there, I don't think there was a dry eye in the house.
Yes, yes.
You know, people were sobbing, you know. And there's sobbing and then there's an anger and there's a search for an understanding. And I wanted to ask you, let's talk about the genesis, the origins of the play, because this wasn't like something that was easy for you to do.
Yes, no, this play was one of those plays that I was reluctant to write. I knew about the incident. The play is based on the shooting of Tyesha Miller, a young woman, back in 1998 in Riverside, California. And I knew about the incident when it happened, and I was reluctant to write this play. As a playwright, we're often looking for things that move us and that want us to tell those stories. I knew about the incident, and I didn't want to tell this story because I didn't like the place that it put me in when I thought about it. Also, I didn't think I had the ability to write it, but also I didn't want to feel like I was capitalizing on something so tragic. So it took me until 2005 to write Dreamscape, and when I sat down to write it, I wanted to make sure that it was a piece of theater that could be transcendent, something that could be about this specific incident, but that could also be about all these types of incidents and all these types of moments that occur within the African-American community specifically, but really within communities that are powerless, communities that are at someone else's under someone else's control.
Well, let me ask you, before we get into that exactly, let me ask you this, because I read somewhere where you said that this play was born of necessity.
Yes.
You know, let's talk about that, because it's kind of heavy, because like you're saying, you see this, and look, I was living out here when Tyesha Miller got killed.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember how I felt, and I remember how angry I was, but, you know, it's sort of like, and I, you know, my initial thing would have been, write something, damn it, say something, do something, you know, but you, and it was more, I think you step back a minute, because, you know, and it was more, I think it seems like to me it was more than just sort of, well, would I be jumping on this and sort of, you know, jumping to do something that maybe shouldn't be done now or shouldn't be done at that moment. But you said it was actually when you decided to do it, that it was actually you had to do it because it was born of necessity.
Yes. Yes. There is, you know, so as an artist, we talk about the fact that we what is inside of us is what comes out on a page or on a stage or however we express our artistry. And for me, having a 22-year-old African-American son, and watching him grow up, this was 2005, so he was, you know, much younger at that point, and looking at what kind of existence he would have if things continued the way they continued. And so as a father and as a man, it became necessary for me to do something. And people do things within the context of their existence, meaning I'm a playwright, I'm a director. So for me, the thing to do was to create something that could speak to how do we alter this? How do we change this? How do I leave the world a little better for him when I'm gone? And so that was the specific and the immediate part of the reason for creating this play. I was also in Cincinnati, Ohio from 1998 to 2000. And during that period, there were about 18 African-American men who were shot over a three-year period by authorities in a very small radius area around the University of Cincinnati. And so once again, this resonated with me, as well as, you know, the presence of my son, as well as being aware of the Tyesha Miller case, as well as having lived in L.A. and you know, been around during the Rodney King uprising. And so all of these things came together, and they forced me to write this play.
Mm-hmm. Although you also said, I'm not writing a bioplay. I'm not writing something that's just going to go out there and say, this is Tyesha Miller's
Absolutely.
Life.
You know, I took the liberty of using the incident as the point of departure for a play that explored the relationship between the African-American community and the police, the historic kind of tenuous relationship that has existed since emancipation, that has existed through Jim Crow, that has existed through the 60s, through the 70s. And so this play was intended to explore that relationship and not to talk about Tyesha Miller, who she was, what she might have grown up to be, what her existence was like on a daily basis. But with that said, the point was to write a play that explored the idea of answering the question, if I was a 19-year-old African-American woman being shot by the police in 1998, what thoughts might be going through my head? What might I think about when I'm shot in the arm or in the leg or in the head? And so using that as the impetus for the dialogue, for the narrative, for the stories, I coupled that with the police report, with the 911 call, with the coroner's report, and created a piece that is it's a hybrid of fact-based theater as well as more traditional playwriting with the elements or the aesthetics of hip-hop theater that drives the narrative.
And we're going to get into that in just a little bit.
Yes.
John, Rachel, let me ask you this, because one of the things, when I'm listening to Kirby and what he's saying, it's like it's very moving, but it's also there's also a question here of one of the things that he did, that he does, and he's kind of being very modest here, but, you know, when I think back on what happened to Tyesha Miller, for so many of us that were angry about it, you know, to a large extent, not for the family and other people that knew her, but for so many of us, she was left as one-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
And what Rick Kirby's done and what you do, and you too, John, what you bring to this, but when you as the actor in the play, you bring such an amazing all-sidedness. You fill Tyesha Miller, you fill that character out, Maisha Mills, the mm-hmm. character in the play, but you fill her out. And so what we see there is just such a flowering of life, and it makes the snuffing out of that so much more, you know, enraging. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, I wanted to bring the character to life. I wanted to do this play justice and to really allow the idea and the humanity of this character to come across, and the beauty of her and her confidence and everything she does, the way she moves. I just wanted to really put that out there and make it as poetic and beautiful as it was written.
You know, it's interesting because the person that I went to see the play with was saying, you know, that it was just sort of like, you know, you look at it and there was one scene in there where you're describing how all these colleges were looking at you and were offering you, you know, a possibility of going to college. But I forgot to turn in. But see, there's a beauty to that because mm-hmm. there's so many kids that age, mm-hmm. you know, and there's so many kids that, you know, particularly people who, you know, you can strive all you want, but sometimes you got to face the reality that this mm-hmm. society is not. You could end up Freddie Gray with a severed spine, mm-hmm. you know. And this is something really beautiful that you brought to that, because you really. And there is this human. You brought the humanity out in the most beautiful way possible. Now, a lot of it had to do with the words, but you also instilled it. And quite frankly, Your dance is incredible, okay?
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's talk about that a little, because the dance actually, you have this whole thing of sort of, there's so much that's sort of both concentrated in and explodes.
Yes.
12 times during the show, basically, or maybe more.
Yes. Well, we have an amazing choreographer. Her name is Carrie Michaels, and we work together. She choreographed the beginning dance, the end, and some in between we mostly work together on. Through the years, it has changed. It has built, because with John and I working together so closely, what it has become during when she's being shot in those particular spaces, what I do is I just think of, okay, so where the gunshot hit, what does it affect and how does it affect it? And with his voice and his amazing, powerful beats, I do my best to recreate that within the movement. And that's where it comes from for me.
How hard was it to go from bullet-riddled, you know, dead person to vivacious teenager?
Oh.
Constantly.
It is a challenge. It is a struggle. What has helped me through the years is meditation, being able to control my breath, being able to control a state of mind that I put myself in, and being able to be in that space when I need to be in that space.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And today we're talking with the director and writer of the play Dreamscape, Rick Kirby Hines, and the actors Rachel Walker and John Foz Merchant. John, let's move over to you for a minute here.
Yes, sir.
Wow. I couldn't believe it. Folks, you have to understand, the set is two dining room chairs back to back, okay? And in the beginning, you see Rachel come out, but John's sitting there, and it's just, how the hell did you come up with the beats in that, the sound, the entire soundscape from you, including the fact that you play a number of different characters in the play?
Yes.
This is a hell of a job.
Thank you. I've been beatboxing, started when I was 6 years old, and in relation to the play, there were... when I initially got the script, there were certain samples that were written in by Rick Kirby, and the rest of it was, you know, scratches, samples in series of ones, twos, and basically Rick Kirby gave me the freedom to go out and explore different samples to incorporate. And what I did was, is I researched and came back with different songs and samples that would be related to the particular gunshot, in particular to the character that Rachel was developing, to find out, you know, what might she have been listening to, or what was my favorite song during that time, to kind of make it even more real and to examine the language that hip hop, you know, presents to us, you know, and what that does to our culture and how it almost kind of takes us away from reality, but then also bring you back to that reality.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Do you guys have something prepared that people can hear?
All right. Yes.
Of course.
Why don't you set it up, tell people what it is, and then we'll go to it.
Okay, great. So what we are going to – this is the prologue. This is the very beginning of the play, and this is the Maisha character bringing us into her thoughts when she first hears the cops' sirens approaching the gas station where she was passed out in the car. So this is that scene.
Soon as I hear the cop sirens, the first thing to pop into my mind, man, I wish I was a white girl. Not white in the I got blue eyes and I can flip my hair kind of way, but in the officer, can you help me out kind of way. In the young lady, are you okay? You look distressed kind of way. In the are you okay? You look lost. You need a ride kind of way. But not today. Tonight, my name is Maisha, and I'm black. Might have had a little drink, those are just the facts. But even still with all that, I figure I should still be all right. I mean, if Tony couldn't hear me, I must be asleep, right? And if I'm sleeping, I'm dreaming, so it must be deep, right? And if I'm deep asleep, the police will just wake me up, right? Show some care, help me find a spare, even help jack me up, right? To protect and to serve, written in black and white, right?
I observed that the vehicle's occupant was in dire medical distress and in need of immediate medical assistance. I observed that the vehicle's occupant's mouth was slightly open, her eyes were closed, her breathing appeared shallow, her lips were quivering, her body was shaking, and there was a white substance that was accumulating around the sides of her mouth. Based on my prior experience with persons overdosing on drugs, I believe Mills was experiencing symptoms which were consistent with drug overdose. Believing that time was of the essence, I thought that we should use the quickest means available to remove the gun from her presence to make it safe for emergency personnel to render any aid. So I would attempt to break the window and remove the gun from her presence.
So I'm strapped with my Gat Essential and Brockton 38 in my lap, case I get rocked on.
After verifying that all the officers were in position, I performed a silent three count. I then broke the window on my first attempt using the ASP baton. I then dropped the baton and leaned to tuck my body into the front window to remove the weapon. But as I reached in to grab her gun, I heard a boom, which I believed to be a gun blast go off towards my right ear.
So I'm strapped with my Gat Essential and Brock gun 38 in my lap, case I get rocked on.
Once inside the vehicle, I can no longer see the weapon. I immediately fell backwards into the pavement, injuring my legs and wrist. I then saw the occupant rise forward in her seat, and while believing that I had been shot and thinking that she was attempting to shoot me again, I began firing into the driver's side door of the vehicle.
I mean, if Tony couldn't hear me, I must be asleep, right?
I began firing into the driver's side door of the vehicle.
If I'm sleeping, I'm dreaming, so it must be deep, right?
I began firing into the driver's side door.
If I'm deep asleep, the police will just wake me up, right?
I began firing into the driver.
Help me find a spare. Even help jack me up, right?
I began firing.
Right?
I began firing.
Right?
I began firing.
Right?
I began firing.
Right? Ever have one of those dreams where nothing comes out when you try to scream?
Worst come to worst, my people, they come first. The entrance to gunshot number one. Squeeze first, ask questions last. The entrance to gunshot number one is located on the right upper arm. This is a typical distant gunshot wound entrance. The course of the projectile is through the skin and soft tissue of the right upper arm, perforating and fracturing the right humerus. This is a non-fatal gunshot wound to the right upper arm, fracturing the humerus.
Did he just say humerus? I think he said humerus. That's funny. What's not so funny is the fact that me, Shy, and Tony been working on this new routine. You know, for when we hit the scene. Yeah, that's right. We them girls. You know the ones. Get you on the dance floor thinking you'll have some fun. Thinking you'll get your grind on. Get your freak on. Maybe even get you some. But as soon as we get you on the floor, you realize you get none. We bust out the routine we came here to do. We ain't being mean. It's just how we do what we do. So you end up standing there bobbing your head. Wonder if you don't get some attention. Create a little tension. So when we see it in your face, give you a taste. Know what I mean? But what you don't realize is that it's all built into the routine.
Maisha, classic girl that I never had. When you know I want to know you later. Girl, I must.
Wow. Wow. Just amazing, folks. And you have to see this. It's at the Los Angeles Theater Center. Downtown, what is it, 514 Spring Street?
Yes, it is.
Yes. And it's what just so we get the time, so I don't forget at the end the time.
So we are doing Thursday, Friday, and Saturday performances at 8 p.m. and Sunday matinees at 3 p.m.
All right. And I'm telling you, we're going to continue talking, but you've got to see this. You just heard a taste of it, and it gets deeper and more. It just wraps itself around your heart and your brain and squeezes the hell out of it. Mm. And if you don't have a good, if you don't have a reaction to it, you're dead. Okay, that's the point. All right, but let me ask you this, because you're John. You're, you know, you have the role. I mean, you actually read the autopsy report, which Rick Kirby. That actually is. It's very heavy that you use that as like the script for this, right? In a certain sense, for that section of the play.
Yeah, you know, the research for this play. There were so many revelations when I started researching the play, and the autopsy report was the first thing that I read. And when I read through this autopsy report, it pretty much told me it gave me the structure for the play. I immediately knew there would be 12 scenes, and I knew that each scene would represent one of the bullets that hit her. And then I started to read kind of this cold, you know, description of this human being. And that just gave me the point of departure for then creating these, you know, these different aspects of her.
You know, it's incredible too, because for the audience, it's like that point about the beauty, as we were talking about, you know, Maisha, as we were talking about what you do with her, Rachel, and what you bring out, and what the text brings out, but also, you know, really what you bring to it in terms of the spirit, right? And it's sort of, you have that, and then you have that cold hard 12 bullets. And John, your voice is incredibly just at that place of where, you know these people who get up there, and they get up there in the news, they get up there, whatever, and they just say the most horrific things in just a very steady, but you have such a, there's a timbre to your voice, there's a certain, it's like, it's very, very, it really works, guys. It really works well. It's like, and it is, it's that constant slamming between the beauty of life and the just horror of this kind of murdered death, So let me ask you a question, Rachel. You said when people asked you, apparently at one performance some time ago, some people asked you, and it was around Trayvon Martin, I guess, and they asked you if you thought of Trayvon Martin as you were performing. And you said yes, but you also said something that I thought was actually very, very profound, because what you said is that you answered it by saying that, yes, this is a wound that never closes. Let's talk about that. You don't remember saying it.
For me, I think about all of them. I think about every single person, and even the people that are still here with us. This is my way of giving. This is my way of standing up. This is my way of protesting to keep all of those spirits alive, to keep us alive, to talk, to be a voice. And this is my way of expressing it and being able to do this with the talent that I've been blessed with.
And this is both for John and McKirby. The point about hip-hop and the whole hip-hop generation, to a certain extent, which is actually an actual full-blown generation at this point. The fact that that generation is so much the target of what happens right now, and so much a generation that this system is saying it has no future for. Let's talk about that in terms of how to infuse, John, your what you've done with this play, and then I'll come back to you, Rick Kirby.
I think there is a heavy misunderstanding with what hip-hop is, and that's one of the things that we take pride in exhibiting and showing, that there are youth, and this generation is very talented and has so much to offer and to deliver into the world. And really all it is just tapping into that and extracting it from them, extracting these talents and these gifts, these ideas and creativity that the younger generation has, and allowing them to, show that they're more than just what gets publicized as far as what hip hop is.
There's something too, though, that actually happens when you look at this. I was thinking about Freddie Gray, 25 years old. Now imagine this. He was okay to do what they did to him, chase him, to stop him, to arrest him.
Yeah.
Because he was a black man in a high crime area. And you think about, that's the generation we're talking about, a 25-year-old kid. And Taisha, I'll say those both those names because I want to be true to what you're saying about that. But, the same thing, 19 years old, you really see what you've portrayed with what you've written and what you guys have brought to life on the stage is this 19-year-old kid who's bursting with life and who ends up with a rail between her arms and her feet and carrying her off like a dead slave. This is just insane. So let's talk.
Part of the dilemma with hip hop culture is that some of the things that are glorified as a means of empowerment have become the excuse for so many things happening to young people from this generation. And so, when NWA puts out a song that says, F the police, and that becomes a means of saying, when I drive around LA and when I'm pulled over for no reason and when these things happen, the only thing I can do is to speak out, yell at the top of my voice. But that yelling then becomes the definition of the person who then in turn becomes a target because of the yelling that occurred, because someone caused them to yell. And it's this ongoing cycle that allows for these types of things to happen. I was recently speaking to a teacher, actually to my sister, who's a teacher in LA, and she was talking about a young man who was recently suspended for something that happened, and he became upset and said something about being suspended in his anger, which in turn caused more suspension, caused more things to happen. And so not having a voice, not having a way of yelling out when you need to, because if you yell too loud, you will be labeled as blank, and then you will be treated as that. And so this idea of taking hip-hop theater and taking hip-hop culture and putting it on stage so that we can tell this entire story, so that we can have an audience sit through and experience this narrative and experience this journey, and then look at how this is, once again, this is not just about Taisha or this character, but it's about those thousands and thousands of voices who are sitting in the car saying, listen, you're supposed to help me out when I call 911. Or at least give me enough of an opportunity to wake up from this, you know, whatever this space I'm in.
Right. That's exactly the point, is that even give me the opportunity.
Give me the opportunity.
There's a generation. But that's the thing, is that when you look at this, the standard operating procedure for this system right now is, if you're young and you're black, you literally have a target on you, and you're it's open season. I mean, think about it, one every 28 hours.
Yeah.
You know, this is just, you know, if it was happening, you know, if people just took a slight look back, I talked about the Armenian genocide, the genocide that happened in Germany against the Jewish people, yeah. All these things, you think about that. And can't we see parallels here? And I'll end with this, because we have a whole nother crew waiting to come in,
yeah.
But I'll end with this, because there's a point that you made about, and I thought it was beautiful, after the thing, and it was very difficult for people to talk, but after the thing, it was so necessary. You came out there with Kirby and you said, look, we need to have a conversation. What do you want that conversation to be?
Wow. You know, that for me, that conversation really is about us finding each other's humanity. And I know that sometimes is this really abstract form, this thing that we talk about. But, you know, we've toured this play around to different places. We've gone over to Europe. We've toured it in places like Poland, where, you know, it's not so much about race there, but it's about the powerful and the powerless. And the ability to experience and see someone else's humanity, that's why this play is about us exploring this young woman, to see that there is a human being in that mix. And once we put a number or a label onto that human being, then it becomes easy for us to go, oh, yeah, those who are like that are expendable. It becomes more difficult to do that, I believe, when we see each other as human beings. And that's the conversation.
Absolutely. All right. I want to thank you. We're Kirby Hines, Rachel Walker, and John Foss Merchant. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And they're here. We're talking about the play Dreamscape. And again, it's at Los Angeles Theater Center, which is 514 Spring Street, and it's running
Thursdays through Saturdays, 8 p.m. We close on the 17th of May, and on Sundays at 3 p.m. matinees. Please come check us out.
Actually, I would say not just please. I'd say do not miss this. Right? Do not miss this. It's imperative. All right, folks. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the members of the play, the director, the writer, and the one of the characters, the lead character in the play, recorded in Hollywood. So stay tuned.
My darling dear, love you all the time. I'm just a fool, a fool in love with you. Earth angel, the one I adore, love you forever and ever. I'm just a fool, a fool in love with you.
All right, welcome back. That song was Earth Angel by the Penguins, all right? And there's a reason for that, because I'm telling you, folks, this play recorded in Hollywood was something that a friend turned me on to. And when I heard about it, I was just my mind was blown. And when I went to see it, was even more the case, okay? It was even more the case because, one, it's a piece of history that I never knew about. And it's something that, you know, and I actually really am very deeply into music, okay? And joining us to talk about this play recorded in Hollywood, which is at the Lillian Theater over in Hollywood, just off of Santa Monica Boulevard and just west of Vine. I was joining the director, Denise Dowse.
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Denise. How are you?
I'm good.
I saw you that night. You were dressed very cool. That's the thing that stuck out with you. Because I passed you on the sidewalk. I said, damn, she's dressed cool. And Jamel Dolphin?
Yes.
How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
You're the grandson of John Dolphin, and you're the author of the book that the play is based on, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And Stu James, who plays John Dolphin in the play. Stu, welcome.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Sure. Hey, that's a hell of a voice, man.
Dude, it's back.
There you go. Oh, yeah, I heard you were losing your voice. Well, somebody want to tell me the story. Tell people the story of the play, just so they know.
Yeah, I'll touch on it. It's the story of my grandfather, John Dolphin. It starts in the late 40s. And goes to the 50s, to about the late 50s. So it's based on his vision, his record store there in South Los Angeles, near the Central Avenue during that big time. Central Avenue was basically the music mecca on the West Coast. And it takes place there with him, I guess, starting with his record shop and growing it into more than just a record shop. It became more of a record superstore. So he had a recording booth in there. He had a radio station. We had a live DJ there in the window. He would attract crowds from all over Los Angeles, and it became a well-integrated scene. And then that didn't mix well with the Los Angeles PD. So it became issues with the LAPD and the police chief Parker and my grandfather, and just became a big issue. And the play kind of it touches on all of this.
Now, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. You're saying that the Los Angeles Police Department did not like the idea of black people, white people, and Latino people mixing? Oh, the devil you said. Well, who would have thought that?
Right.
What
right.
Very important. But there's a little bit more to it. So I wanted to ask you, Denise, talk about, you came in to direct this. How did you come on to this?
I was referred to Jamel, and he was referred to me through a parent of a student that I used to teach. And we met about a year ago, and he got the script to me. But what compelled me to say yes was he came to me with no script, but the passion that he had behind the storytelling is what got me interested. So I'm like, okay, let's read a script and let's see where we are. And what I love about John Dolphin is that he was a businessman initially, but music touches lives and changes lives, and it changed his and it affected his life. So what became what he when he started out as a businessman, he also became socially active with Leon Washington, the owner of the Sentinel at the time. And because of the relationships between he and the police and him going to jail more than once, we show it once in the show, but that changed him. And he saw what music effect had on people, and it didn't matter what color they were. Mm-hmm. It was just that they had a good time together.
Mm-hmm. All right, man, Stu. You got to – now, you're carrying weight. And I got to tell you, when you – I was sitting in the front row, man, and you came up and, hi, Clinton. I'm like – Whoa.
Mm-hmm. Was that you?
Yeah, it was me.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the one person right there.
No. I get it, yeah.
Yeah, no, but the point is that, you know, you brought to life in a multidimensional way John Dolphin. And it was very important because you saw his warts as well as mainly the big things about him. Because this is a cat. You got Jamal, you noticed from he's your grandfather and your research and you wrote the book. He's a cat who actually not just – broke music, but he broke barriers in society, including with the music, you know. Yeah. You know, because look, I grew up in Philadelphia and I listened to Wibbage, right? WIBG which actually started out as a station of Why I Believe in God, right? But then it became an early rock station, you know. Wow. And you're looking at this and you're thinking, this is incredible, you know. And I remember it was where I first heard things like Earth Angel or some of these other things that were songs that actually shaped a lot of my teenage years. Yeah, I'm 112. Okay. But, you know, that was the kind of thing that went on. And so I wanted to – what was it like playing this kind of character?
You know, I am I'm just honored to be able to be on this journey with this cast, with this director, with these producers. Seriously, because, you know, it's – I feel like it's big shoes to step in. But I just want to be honest and truthful to telling the story. I mean, I've read the script. I read it over and over and over again. I'm reading the book right now. Go online, do some research. Jamel and I have done some interviewing online back and forth. So just to get information. And I have intuitive hits of what feels right for him. And I just trust and, you know, honor those hits. I think he was a Renaissance man. He was ahead of his time. I mean, who in the world in the late 40s, 50s would think about a record shop with a recording studio, a small recording booth, and a radio station in it? I'm like, and if you think about it, the big window is the precursor to Good Morning America in New York City. I mean, who back in the 40s, a big window advertising, boom. But it makes sense as I'm reading the book. It makes sense what he's doing. Yeah, I can make the records right here. I can put them on my radio station, and I can sell them. So he was innovative thinker ahead of his time. He was a businessman. He was he was passionate, you know, about his family. You know, he had you know, we all have our so-called dark moments. He had, you know, his dark side as well. But I think the cool thing is that he realized there's a redemption within him that is bigger than me.
And it was redemption that actually involved going up against everything that said he not only he can't do it, but black people can't do this.
Right.
And then young people, black and white, can't come together. Jamel, let's talk about that, because you didn't know your grandfather, but you stumbled onto this in a certain sense, right?
Yes.
What did you how did you think of this when you came out? What did you think when you found out this?
Well, I thought it was incredible what he did, and I thought it was just a travesty that people didn't know about it. And he did so much for just the community, just for the city of Los Angeles, changed a lot of things through music. And it's just the fact that people did not know him, and the story is unheard, and his accomplishments is overlooked. And that was my passion in bringing in doing the book. That is what drove me.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting too, though, because when we talk about what he did, I really want people to understand this, because this is a cat who, when you said, okay, first of all, he did go to Hollywood and say, I wanted to be Dolphins of Hollywood. I want to be up on Sunset Boulevard. And they said, eh, not a black guy. No, go away, right?
Yeah.
And then he goes back and he opens it up at Central and Vernon. Now, I've heard a lot because I was into jazz when I first came out here, and still am. But I learned a lot about the Central Hotel and that whole scene, the club scene down there, and how a lot of white Hollywood would come down into the area.
Dunbar.
Yeah.
Dunbar Hotel.
Dunbar Hotel. Yeah, right. That's it. And, I would learn how all this stuff happened, and the things began to break open. And then there was this point about the police coming in, and they, there's been a historic attack on jazz. I mean, look at New York. You know, mm-hmm. what did they do? They prevented jazz from ever getting a real mass base, a widespread mass base. But John Dolphin fought against that in a certain way. He fought to actually get the music out as far and wide, and he had the audacity to basically say, you know what? I'm going to a white radio station. I'm going to broadcast on a white radio station. I'm bringing black music to white kids. This is a very heavy thing, man.
That's bold. Back in those days.
Yeah, race music.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but and it's interesting because the way you actually portray the direction you've given this, because you get this sense, and there's a certain innocence that comes out in all of the actors to a certain extent when they're mixing together. And I kept looking at the white guys and, why's that guy got that goofy smile? And then all of a sudden I'm like, no, wait a minute. It's because there's an innocence.
Yeah.
There's an innocence that's riding on a wave of very profound things. It's about to break through to actually, and it had a lot to do with, and this is one of the reasons why the police went after that, because it had a lot to do with declaring that not only should people be together, but people should be together on the basis of recognizing their common humanity. And to me, that was a huge thing,
And how awesome for this music.
Yeah,
universal language to bring us all together.
Well, name some of the cats that performed there. Some of the people that performed there.
They're at the radio shop.
Yeah.
Oh, he would have almost every artist that came to Los Angeles would come through the shop, and they would perform. They would go on the radio station. They would promote their records. They would sign. They would sign autographs for teenagers. I mean, they would pretty much everyone. I have seen pictures from Ike and Tina Turner.
Wow.
Stevie Wonder, James Brown,
Nat King Cole.
I haven't seen pictures of Nat King Cole, but I have heard he's been there. Elvis Presley, they all will come there.
No, there's something here too, because we won't necessarily give away the end, but the point is that at a certain point there was the guy who plays the theme song for this show, which is Let There Be Drums, is a guy named Sandy Nelson.
Yeah,
who was there in the final scene. In the John Dolphin story.
Really?
Right? Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And he was there with the guy who was forming the Beach Boys as well. Right.
Bruce Johnston.
So you think about this. It's really heavy because, there's that clamoring to bring people together on a certain level. And some of the most beautiful music that, you can think of.
Sure.
And, it is very interesting because, well, Denise, I'd ask you this because you're doing this, you're directing this, and it's not, look, folks, this is not like a small, it's in a 99-seat theater, which we need a whole hell of a lot more of those, and we need to protect them. But I'll tell you what, it's also a situation where you're looking at this and you're saying, there's a bigness to this story that has to be told. And I have to comment, you did a wonderful job in putting a gigantic musical on in a tiny little space.
Thank you.
With all that liveliness and humanity, it was really incredible. What was that like?
You try to paint the best picture you can, and I worked with an amazing set designer, Joel David, who came up with these revolving trapezoids, or I call them toitles, and it allowed our venues to change. And then it was sort of like, well, how do we make it just be as seamless as possible? And so it was also incorporating the cast as also our set changers. And 18 people on a stage that size, and they're singing and dancing and moving and grooving, and it's magic. It is magic to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And the beauty of this too is that even when people were changing the set, it was all done in the rhythm of the show.
Sure.
So it was like it looked like a busy record store.
Yeah,
exactly.
So
like, awesome.
Very cool. Let me tell people when it's playing and the address of the theater.
We're playing Fridays, Saturdays at 8 and Sundays at 3. We're at 1076 Lillian Way, a block and a half west of Vine, mm-hmm. off of Santa Monica Boulevard. Yep, and we're running it right now until May 17th with possible future.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's, you know, and again, you know, when you think about this, folks, it's you know, all of the songs that people look back on and say those were the incredible songs, those were the really incredible songs. Those are the songs that actually need to, you know, this is what this play is and what it brings to life in here. And I do have to say, I thought when I saw the role of the police in this, it was very apropos for today and forever, actually. Yeah. You know, from the earliest foundations of this place. But the idea and the whole idea that this heavy-handed arm of the state that had no interest other than beating, closing down, and stopping the stuff, that the threat that was there was actually, I think, the recognition of the humanity of black people and the bringing people together on that basis, which to me seemed to be a huge, huge part of the play.
Right. Definitely. Mm-hmm.
So what's up, man? What are you going to do now?
Well, we're gonna grow the musical. We have a awesome director, Denise. We have an incredible cast, including Stu. I mean, we're just gonna grow it. We're gonna try to build on this and what we're doing, the momentum that we have, and take it to a bigger stage where it needs to be.
An assertion of life in the face of all this horror is definitely needed right now. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Denise Dowles, the director of the play recorded in Hollywood, Jamel Dolphin, the author of the book, and the grandson of John Dolphin, and actor Stu James, who plays John Dolphin in the play. Don't miss it, folks. It's really another one to definitely be seen. We're not going to take anything. I'm going to thank all of my guests today, and I'm going to say thank you to my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board officer today, Federico Garcia, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going out now with Swamp Dog, and Prejudice is alive and well, all right?
Luckman Fine Arts Complex at Cal State LA presents World Arts Day, India, Saturday, April 25th at 5 p.m. World Arts Day is designed to give the community an opportunity to express and interact with various art forms from around the world. This open ticketless event will focus on the diverse artistic traditions of India. All events are hands-on, interactive, and open to all. Activities include henna hand painting, incense workshops, Rangoli sand art, Bollywood dancing, and more. World Arts Day India. More info at luckmanarts.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support KPFK. One of the best ways you can do it is simply by calling and becoming a sustainer, pledging $10 or more each month. In that way, you help to protect this independent radio station. And sign up today.
To become a member of KPFK's sustainer program, please call 818-985-2711, dial extension 0, and speak with an operator about joining.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7.